Welcome to Brands Decoded podcast, where we speak with some of the best founders crafting the next generation of brands. I'm Rahul from Times Internet, where we back consumer internet companies.
Hi, I'm Zoeb from Sauce VC that backs early stage consumer brands. We came together to build the Brands Decoded community, where members eat, drink, sleep, and craft brands.
Our guest today is Rohan Mirchandani, co-founder and CEO of Grums Foods, the company behind Epigamia and Hokey Pokey ice cream. Some twists, some turns, and a lot of Greek yogurt to talk about. We'll hear more about how Grums drives innovation and took some hard decisions. Pleasure to have you with us today, Rohan.
Thanks, Rahul, for having me on.
So you make Greek yogurt sitting in the US and are backed by a French and Belgian investor, and you sell to India. You've got to be making a really large global business. So tell us probably in a couple of minutes, how did this even begin?
I mean, I'm sitting in the US now. I've been in India for 7 years. And then, of course, with this whole crisis, I've back here with my family to be with them for some time. And it's been interesting working, being here in the United States, but working on India hours. So not much time for sleep, especially since I've got two little guys. So it keeps me on my toes. It's been an interesting journey. Grew up in the United States, and not to cut a very long story short, moved to India in 2013, right after B school. Prior career was in finance, and in business school, I got inspired by what was happening with consumer brands in India. I'd taken a small course in Mumbai, was really, really excited about what the coming decades were going to bring. Some of my guest lecturers were industry stalwarts, and was really inspired and motivated by, what I call sort of, brands that are going to be born this last 5-7 years and the 5-7 years ahead, that in my mind will stand the test of time as far as India is concerned, especially in the consumer space. CPG, of course, is where we play, but we're seeing that now with personal care and other areas as well. Food CPG, but CPG in general is what I see. And it's been a very interesting journey. It's been even more interesting given what's happened the last 1 year with COVID, but very excited about the times to come.
That's true. There are certain, it's a popular saying that years or decades, when things don't move, and then there are weeks that decades move. So with terms of online adoption, I think we've seen those decades in a matter of weeks.
Yes, absolutely.
Right. Keeping that in mind, Rohan, from what I've researched on Epigamia, you guys started out with a very heavy offline or retail presence. Same goes for your marketing efforts. And now we're seeing a very strong shift towards digital. So I would love to know how your strategy is evolving for this, and perhaps how you may look to embrace the D2C channel overall.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think to be honest, digital was always an area of focus from a communication perspective for us, not from a trade or transaction perspective, right? So we were always digitally second or third as far as commercial transactions were concerned perspective. And that's just the nature of our business, being food, being short shelf life. And, while we had to develop a cold chain ecosystem, that itself was a challenge. To develop it, all the way to the door of an individual consumer was unthinkable just a year and a half ago. I mean, just not something that was on the cards. But given that we saw our consumer, our target audience, always very active and transacting on digital, it was always something that intrigued us. But of course, we never formulated it. And as Rahul rightfully said, given that in this sort of 18 months, we've probably seen 10 years of acceleration in terms of adoption and whatnot. We still very much are an omnichannel play. There's no debate on that. But just to give you guys some context, our digital business, and this consists of not just our own B2C, but also our e-com and anything we transact digitally, was perhaps 3-4% prior to last year's lockdown. So let's say February of 2020. Today, that 3-4% has become close to 33% of our overall business, almost a third. you know, which frankly is unheard of, you know, in cold chain, you know, for us in cold chain in India in general. But it's not just us, of course, it's happened to everyone. Yes, for us, because our target audience, you know, we're already transacting online, the friction was very low for them to start doing that. It was just a matter of offering. And the offering came vis-a-vis e-com players now, you know, ramping up their cold chain deliveries, last mile players ramping up their cold chain deliveries, and us taking a front end stand and, you know, launching our own direct to consumer vis-a-vis Shopify or whatever. And it's been absolutely insane just to see the data, the numbers, having direct access. You know, our whole, you know, innovation pipeline has now completely been accelerated. We're thinking very differently how we approach things. Frankly, if you ask me, I don't think we even know the power of this yet. I think it's just getting started. I think we have a sense today, but the more and more we play on digital, the more and more we analyze our data on direct to consumer, the more and more power we see, not just for the digital business, for the omnichannel play as well. You know, just getting city-specific, region-specific information and then deciding, you know, which markets we want to go further, even offline with. You know, it's been a wealth of, I guess it's like a golden nugget that's fallen in our lap. So very excited about this channel, and then very excited about omnichannel in general, you know, because now we will definitely have digital lead the future for us. Again, we don't expect to be purely a digital play. It's just the nature of the business. It's going to be omnichannel, but we expect digital to lead wherever we go.
Very interesting. And since you mentioned about supply chain, Rohan, we learned you literally, you know, crafted the entire cold chain by yourself, as in, like, of course, with the team. But Epigamia created its own cold chain. You know, what was the reason to do that? And I'm sure it's helping in different ways, but it's practically doing a startup in a startup. So would love for you to throw a light on that.
Yeah, you know, I think absolutely, and it's a great way to look at it. I think necessity breeds innovation, right? And I think for us, the way we sort of went about it is, you know, to be very candid and frank and brutally honest, very simply, no distributor wanted to take us on. You know, when we started the journey, and rightfully so. And I always tell everyone, when you get laughed at, you're onto something. I mean, we were literally laughed away by distributors, and, you know, just literally begging and pleading for them to carry our product. And they said, absolutely not. You know, this makes no sense. Kidani jaane wala hai, like, you know, it's very expensive. We're not interested, blah, 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 blah. The big guys have tried. What makes you think you'll succeed? And we realized that to really get this off the ground, you know, we're going to have to do this ourselves. And, you know, it's just a very broken, you know, cold chain system. And this was just 5-6 years ago. And in 5-6 years, the country has gone leaps and bounds in cold chain. And my sense is in 5-6 years, it'll go even further leaps and bounds. But, you know, essentially we had to do it ourselves. And the thought process was, okay, look, we will do this ourselves just to demonstrate the value of this. And then, you know, when we reach a little bit of scale, you know, distributors will likely take it on. What was interesting is the distributors came running, and the same ones that we begged and pleaded and kicked us out of their offices were not only excited about taking us on, they started begging to take us on. But then we realized that our economics were a lot stronger just doing it ourselves, because even then, you know, the distributors, you know, wanted higher margins and whatnot. Now that we've reached even further scale, you know, we're able to dictate and demand. And there's certain areas that we intend to sort of, you know, hand out the distribution, especially if we think that, like, and as I mentioned, the last 5-6 years, we've just seen the ecosystem develop, you know, wholeheartedly. And, you know, some distributors starting to sort of excel in their management of cold chain, temperature control, depot management, deliveries, trucks, supply chain, you know, using technology to monitor the temperature. And that excites us, because, you know, now we can sort of dictate some terms and move back to potentially using distributors, because obviously it's not very scalable if you want to do your own distribution nationwide. It's doable in a region. So, for example, in a city like Mumbai, we're probably one of the largest, if not the largest, cold chain distributors independently. You know, forget the fact that we're just doing one single brand at Epigamia. Similar to Delhi, Bangalore, we're probably second or third. And you know, these are decisions we have to take. Now, we can't be this, you know, our own cold chain distributor in 50 or 100 cities. But we can definitely dabble in a few. But now we've demonstrated the model, and we're very excited about the way that things are heading. So the turning of the tide with digital, and also the turning of and the acceleration of just cold chain processes and systems and players, has really given us tailwinds, as we expand to the next leg of our journey.
Awesome. Thank you for sharing how you built that out. And you mentioned that some of the cities you're operating in, I assume right now that bulk of it is still from tier one cities. But are you looking to build this out more to tier two or tier three cities of India? Because at the same time, we've seen Epigamia's launch of the ghee spreads, which were in countries like UAE or Singapore. So what's the vision to drive penetration for the company?
Yeah, so the UAE Singapore was just a one product, one range, tactical sort of play, because there were some requests that came in from there. It wasn't part of a larger strategic approach, at least not as of today. Our core offering is not available in those countries. It was purely the ghee spreads because it was a large shelf life, didn't require cold chain. It was just a COVID, checkbox tactical play. We have a very long way to go in India. I mean, we have just touched, it's the tip of the iceberg. There's a lot to do in the cities we currently are in as well, right? Just availability perspective. To give you a sense, we're in approximately 1,800 distribution points in a city like Mumbai, whereas the universe for us is something like 7,000-8,000, touch points. The idea is, as we get further and further, as I mentioned to you, these 1,800, we do our own distribution. But when we get to sort of region specific and maybe more smaller Kirana shops, we're in most of the big ones, or let's say the B and C grade. But when we get to the D and E grade, and by that, I'm not trying to say the quality of the stores. The stores' qualities are extremely high. It's just more so about the footprint, the size, the kind of products they carry. And we see our products selling in those stores, but not the kind of volumes you get from the larger stores, so that it doesn't justify the logistics costs. But when you start working with regional distributors in certain regions, for them to cover those is much easier because they're also going with other products. So a lot to do in the cities we currently are in. We're not done yet. But we've seen a huge expansion in tier two for ourselves, and that's just getting started. So we're now about 20-25% of our business coming from tier two. But we also see a big play in tier three. It's just a function of now with scale and with cold chain development, working with just the right partners and distributors in those cities, because again, we can't be doing our own distribution. So we've got a couple of models we've set up. One, of course, is direct. Second is sort of the simple, work with the distributor, but of course, make sure that they have the right systems and processes in place to manage the cold chain. And then third, we've got some hybrid models where we've set up where, the distributor does sort of the billing and the accounting, and then we work with them operationally. We appoint someone at their site, to work, on the operational level, making sure the technology is always updated, the data is always available for us to access, setting up a DMS system, et cetera. And these things are all working really well. So to answer your question, Zoyab, very long way to go in India. I think tier two is going to be a huge push this year. Tier one itself will be a huge push expanding. And then I think the next phase will be tier three, tier four for us. The international markets are just going to be opportunistic, not a focus area right now at all. If something comes our way where we see, where it makes profitable sense, we may approach it. What we did so far was just a pure one-off product tactical sort of play.
Very cool, Rohan. Thanks so much for sharing that. I actually, want to dwell deeper into that. You said we're just scratching the surface in India, right? But typical Epigamia products, right? Like for example, a Greek yogurt, or an almond milk, right? I just want to get a sense, like when you say tier three, right? Is there an audience match for that? Or you're thinking that, okay, there's a Mishti Dohi as well. And maybe people relate to that. And that's the only kind of like a separate line of products that you essentially look to, launch in tier three markets?
Yeah, it's interesting because, when we look at sort of our saliency geographically within a city, right? And you look at, one would think, let's take Mumbai, for example, because that's obviously home turf, but, you tend to think, Epigamia is, predominantly, just selling in a South Bombay or a Bandra, for example, a suburb like Bandra or Juhu. And yes, while the volumes per store and throughputs are higher there, You know, we still have a very significant business that comes from places like Borivali and Dahisar, that comes from Thane, you know, that comes from Mulund, you know, that comes from Dombivli, that comes from Kalyan. And those are markets that are, you know, probably the fastest growing markets, you know, within a city like Mumbai, where you're seeing some of the older kirana shops modernize. Of course, there's been a little bit of hold during COVID, but actually during COVID, those shops have done fantastic because they've held their fort, you know, because they're available neighborhood stores where, you know, maybe perhaps the modern trade doesn't have access to. And we saw that happen during COVID, where our, along with our digital business, our GT business went up 40-50%. So when you look at those sub-markets and you look at the sort of, you know, amazing quality of consumers there, that trickles to a Pune and Ahmedabad and even all the way to a Jodhpur and a Jalandhar, right? It trickles to a Vijayawada, you know, it trickles to a Mangalore. And while, yes, in a tier one city, you know, your audience is going to be larger, you know, and let's say your size of distribution is 7,000-8,000 stores in a Mumbai, a similar number in Bangalore, perhaps 12,000-15,000 in NCR, you know, doing a 600-800 store operation in tier two, tier three is extremely, extremely doable. We've seen it happen. I mean, Pune now is doing really well, though Pune is still a metro city, but, you know, we have places that are doing extremely well in terms of our business, you know, places like Guwahati, Lucknow, Patna we started recently. What's more important is not necessarily the type of consumer. The type of consumer exists. That is not an issue. Income levels are you know, we've noticed, you know, 8 lakh family household income and above is game for us. Of course, within our target audience of 28 to 35, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But without going too much into a marketing conversation, what's extremely compelling and interesting is, how do we sort of, you know, make these people aware of our product and the value proposition that's on the table? And that's where digital plays a big role now for us going forward. You know, leading with the digital first strategy in some of these cities to build awareness and build trials, which is a lot less friction, a lot less expensive than it was in the past. In the past, you'd have to really invest behind putting your product on these shelves, getting promoters to sample them, you know, and then it has a gestation period. That gestation period gets accelerated very fast now with digital. So for us, the focus will be to enter these cities purely digital first, you know, tap on our D2C channel, perhaps not even keep D2C on there forever, maybe just do D2C for some time, get the trials going, work with our partners like Big Basket, Amazon, Dunzo, whoever else is in those markets. And then once we see some traction, you know, immediately go offline and build out that 400-500 store distribution. And that's what something we've already started to do in certain cities. And we're really excited about that model going forward. And that's something that we think is extremely scalable as we move forward, and also very high on ROI, rather than the old way of doing things where you had to go, you know, gung-ho into all these shops, really invest behind the stores, really invest. And it was an expensive proposition. You know, that becomes a lot less friction now going forward.
Right, cool. Great to learn that. I have actually a follow-on question to the previous question. Why do I feel that when you say that, you know, we did our entire supply chain, right? Is just the way eCart was born out of Flipkart, since you specialize in this cold chain, is there going to be another startup shelled out of Epigamia in the future?
That's a billion-dollar question that's discussed internally probably once a week. you know, I think you know, it's something that we talk about all the time, but, you know, there has to be a focus, right? And certainly it doesn't make sense to have a CEO run two different businesses. Yes, you can run two different business units, but, you know, the mission needs to be one and the same. It's something we talk about. And if we ever go that route, it'll be maybe some folks within the current team will work on in that company, but definitely we'll have to look at a very different management team there. It's not something that I intend to, you know, be, you know, CEO of two companies. It just doesn't work. It's not scalable. There's no focus. You know, it just doesn't make any sense. So to answer your question, we don't have a clear answer yet, but it's always a discussion internally.
So Rohan, shifting gears a little bit, given the context of the pandemic, there were a few things I noticed that Epigamia was doing. Firstly, on the social media, there was an entire distribution drive that you had done for healthcare workers. Secondly, on the yogurt cup itself, the lid had on itself printed saluting, hashtag saluting the Corona Warriors. And finally, in Jan of 2021, you launched the Step Up initiative. I suppose the question comes that with the stage and the size that the company is at the moment, it's not necessarily something that you have to do or is expected. So I just want to understand the motivation behind launching this initiative or doing such initiatives, since you are talking about the mission of the company.
Yeah, so, you know, one of the things that, you know, our mission, which doesn't come out very clearly because we don't like to sit and wave the flag. You know, we like our actions to sort of dictate what we stand for, not necessarily just, you know, spoken words, because spoken words, to me, are not as powerful as action, right? But our mission internally at Epigamia is fighting hunger. It's something that, you know, we've not just been doing now, we've been doing from the beginning of Drums Food, you know, even with when we had the ice cream business with Boki Boki, which is what you're aware of, which was our, prior avatar. And we've actually brought it back now, which is exciting, which I can talk about later as well, if you guys are interested. But what it's always been something that we do, you know, the team itself, you know, we've worked with the Robin Hood Army before. We've worked with a lot of kitchens. We've worked with a lot of, you know, homeless shelters in the past. We work with a lot of orphanages in the past. We've been supporting Children's Hope, which is an organization in the United States focused on, you know, orphanages all across India, focused on children and education. And this is something we've been doing for a while. It's not something that's come out recently. Of course, I think given the lens of COVID, a lot of this got accelerated, and I'll talk about that. And you know, things came into the limelight, and we made a program out of it, and I'll talk about why we did that. But it is a mission for us. It's been a mission from day one, you know, which is fighting hunger. And given that we are in 2020 or 2021, you know, hunger should not be something that's talked about. I mean, it's just, we're beyond that now as society, right? But unfortunately, we still have that as an issue in the country. And, you know, it's a rallying cry and a cause that is very close to my heart, but it's also very close to every employee at Drums Food. It's something that we rally around. It's something that gives us purpose, you know, as we look to the future of Epigamia. Of course, we're all, you know, it's a for-profit company, and the idea is to build something special, but building something special just doesn't end at building a brand. The brand has to have a purpose. And for us, that purpose is fighting hunger. And it's been that from day one. I think what has happened, Zoyab, is during COVID, and given that we are in the food business, and given that, you know, some of the structural issues we saw last year during lockdown, where, you know, just plugging into the food systems, because food systems came to an abrupt halt. And you had all these warriors out there, as we discussed, you know, whether they were doctors or nurses or even, you know, at that time, the police that were out there just sort of making sure that the country, you know, doesn't sort of suffer from this crisis. This was last year, of course. We all saw what happened a few weeks ago, which was devastating. But for us, it just sort of put our purpose in the forefront, you know, as we all started having conversations about life and the purpose of life in general with this global pandemic. It just put our mission up front. Front and center, and you know, we decided to formalize it a little bit, and bring it into this program, and it was just an amazing, you know, rallying cry. I mean, we had people within the company. I mean, I think 70% of our company donated their salary anyway from, you know, a few days to up to a month, just to fund you know, this yogurt. And for us, it wasn't about the rupees; it was about actually creating food that we could give. You know, whether it was to migrant workers, like I said, whether it was to the COVID warriors on the front lines, and that, to, you know, sort of accelerated our mission a little bit. As I said, there was always a purpose. It was, I wouldn't say it was sidelined, but it always ran in parallel, and it gave us a little bit of a focus. And you know, I'm very proud to say the team really rallied around this. And for us, it is something that, you know, we intend to sort of, you know, continue doing. It's not just the COVID thing. We will continue doing. We've done a lot of work in the villages where we operate, where our co-packing partners are, where our fruit vendors are, et cetera, et cetera. And it's something that has always been part of the heart. Maybe it's not come out in the open, but it'll always continue to be.
That's really inspiring. And I think every brand, every business should, you know, look up to. That's really, really cool. Rohan, I just also wanted to, you know, dwell into essentially that how large, and I totally get it, right? You're serving both kind of products, dairy and plant-based, right? Just want to understand what kind of a trend emerging are you looking at? And, you know, is the trend going towards plant-based alternatives? And are we going to see a huge population move from dairy to plant-based alternatives?
Yeah, you couldn't avoid the controversial question, right?
No, we can.
I'm kidding. I love the comment. This has been a global conversation. It's obviously come into the limelight very recently. You know, there's been some regulatory conversations going on, some legal conversations going on. It's very interesting. I'll start sort of, you know, on a lighter note and then move to a more sort of serious note. But, on the lighter note, it's funny because there's this sort of global activism, you know, very hardcore activism, you know, against dairy, which is happening, you know, plant-based vegan movement, which we, you know, are sort of advocates for, but we're definitely not activists. You know, we're not part of that activism of what's going on, especially when we're selling dairy products ourselves. On the flip side, you know, there's this anti sort of plant-based movement that's saying, you know, you're trying to take all the glory of you know, dairy or animal-based milk, which is a centuries-old tradition in India, even more so. There's a religious connotation, and you're trying to, you know, exploit that with fake and chemically made, you know, sort of milk, which is not real milk. And it's funny because we, you know, we get slapped in the middle. Like, both sides want to, you know, hate on us. So the activists on one side, you know, think that we're a dairy company and we're the enemy on that side. And then the dairy companies think we're the activists and they think on the other side. And, you know, here we are in between saying, no, we're the peacemakers that want to coexist. We think there's a coexistence for both. And you know, that being said, we actually truly and genuinely believe that, there is a movement globally towards eating more and more plant-based products. Does that mean that, you know, I personally have become a vegan? Absolutely not. I continue to eat, dairy products or animal-based products. You know, that's what I do. Do I believe in plant-based? 100%. Yes. I think, you know, there's, just to give you a very clear example, I have cut down on my animal-based intake. I still think it plays a very important role in terms of the protein that comes from it, and I continue to consume it. But I balance it by eating, you know, more plant-based products. And essentially, you know, if I treat it holistically, you know, we should all be eating more veggies in general, right? That's something that, you know, that's good for all of us. For us, the way we see it is, it's not our place to tell consumers what they should be doing. It's our place to give them, you know, very high quality products with ingredients that they believe in. And let them decide. You know, consumers are intelligent. They should be given choices to choose. It's not our place to, you know, be in their face and say, you know, eat this or die, or if you don't do this, you're a bad person. You know, that's not our place. Our place as Epigamia, that we see as the brand, is to play a role in incorporating this and saying, look, what do you feel, right? If you feel that this is what you should eat every day, by all means, you should. If you feel you should balance it out, by all means, you should. If you feel a vegan diet is the right diet for you, by all means, you should do your own research. Don't let brands push their commercial research on you. You should decide what it is. Our job, which is, you know, the leaders of the contemporary dairy movement, you know, so our goal is to modernize and contemporize this very traditional industry, is to offer all the innovative products that are out there, which is why for us, we actually launched a UHT dairy milk as well. So we have almond milk, we have oat milk in the pipeline. We also have dairy milk that we sell. And believe me when I say this, I'm going to be biased, but all extremely high quality products and can go up on any shelf globally, you know, even though it's 100% made in India. And for us, that's our sort of motivation and our premise and our goal is high quality products that contemporize and modernize dairy. Our goal is not to take a stand. Our goal is to let consumers decide what they want to do. And that's where we sort of play in this. And yes, now to come back to your specific question, I do see more and more vegan products come out. I see more and more vegan. I see the movement, you know, moving ahead. you know, is it going to 100% replace everything we consume? I'm not so sure. I'm not in that camp. Is it going to be incorporated more and more and see a huge business that's going to drive over the years? Absolutely. I totally believe in that. And I think it'll be a nice, healthy balance, which is our, you know, not to sort of plug in our buzzword there, but that's what we are. We're Epigamia is your happy balance. And this will be a nice, healthy balance for consumers to decide.
Rohan, there's been an entire pipeline of products that we've come to expect from Epigamia. How have you designed the entire innovation engine for the same? You know, just to give an example for our listeners, you launched the ghee spreads, and a product such as that was the first we ever seen. So how do you enable this to keep on happening?
Yeah, so you know, for us as a brand, innovation's our DNA, right? It's funny. So I love to say execution's our DNA, but it's not. It's just something we've been forced to do with cold chain and distribution. But innovation is core to what we do. You know, our DNA is innovation, and you know, very interestingly, and your folks at Sauce, Manu will tell you. Because he's been part of the journey from the beginning, when there were so many times when we raised capital or there was conversations that, you know, why aren't we putting up a manufacturing facility? I think we were one of the few that decided not to put up a manufacturing facility, but opted for an R&D lab instead, because we said, that's who we are. We're not manufacturers, we're innovators. And that's what, you know, has always, you know, sort of, you know, stood out for us. The way we look at innovation is three sort of buckets, right? So we look at what we call sort of the mind, body, and soul. So stay with me for a second here. And let's start at the soul first. The soul for us is, you know, not just innovation within India, but innovation on a global level. You know, just cutting edge stuff, highly differentiated, doing stuff that no one's ever seen before. And if it's not, again, something that people are saying these guys are lunatics, or laughing, or crying and saying these guys are honestly, you know, insane. Then it's not innovative, or doesn't belong in our soul. So an example is our ghee spreads. You know, where we, you know, added a chocolate with ghee, or did blueberry with ghee. You know, these are just, you know, for the common person, absolutely insane characters. And if we don't get an insane reaction, it's not part of our soul. And of course our coconut vegan yogurt comes there. Some of the plant-based milks we're going to do come there, et cetera, et cetera. And that's the soul of who we are. And that's one area of innovation where we'll continue to do what I, you know, sort of say that super highly differentiated and crazy and innovative products. The second bucket for us, which is the mind, which is sort of more, and mind is very important because that's the very straightforward business, approach. Is where we launch products that have, you know, potential to scale, but, you know, continue to be very, very good on the P&L. When I mean good on the P&L means, you know, very high gross margins, you know, things of that nature. And for us, that's things like our Greek yogurt smoothie, our no added sugar smoothie. So we have a range of products there that we continue to do, which is sort of top of mind from a business perspective. And then comes the body, which are products that we launch, which we're really looking, you know, to take our distribution reach up. You know, so I think Rahul alluded to Mishti Doi in tier 2, tier 3 cities. But also when I talk about moving from, you know, that 1,500 stores in Mumbai to the 7,000-8,000 mark, or moving from our current, you know, 17,000-18,000 store distribution to the 2 lakh distribution that we're planning on achieving in the next 2 to 3 years. These are your sort of volume products, the body products. So something like a Mishti Doi sits there. Something like curd sits there. We just launched a UHT flavored milk that sits there. We have probiotic yogurt that sits there. Again, all three buckets have you know, a very fast and a focus on R&D, but they all serve very different purposes, and they all serve very different sort of thought processes when we're going about it. So that's sort of the framework that we go about, but all have a very clear strategic objective and have to fall in one of these buckets. If they don't fall in one of these buckets, we won't do the R&D around it. And that's sort of how we approach the lens of innovation at Epigamia.
Sweet. Rohan, next question I'm going to ask you, probably, you know, you're going to break 1 million hearts. how did you get Deepika to invest in Epigamia?
Yeah, absolutely. No, it was great. So, you know, we at Epigamia have always been huge fans of her, and you know, she's just the most amazing person. You know, it's just so much more than just a Bollywood movie star, you know, a visionary and an inspiration across. And you know, it's interesting. We always used to talk about her and, you know, always dreamed of one day saying, you know, one day we'll have someone, you know, represent us. And, you know, hopefully it could be someone like her. And she's someone that fit our profile very well, right? So we, as we talked about, as I alluded to earlier, you know, Epigamia is a contemporary take on tradition, a contemporary take on a very traditional dairy industry. And Deepika herself is a contemporary take on tradition. You know, she's the modern Indian, you know, sort of woman, you know, entrepreneur, visionary, yet sort of rooted in Indian tradition in terms of, you know, her core and who she is. You know, and that's what we love about her. And what was interesting is, you know, always dreamed about it. And then, you know, through some interactions, you know, with her and her team that came about, you know, on how we could potentially work together. You know, we were very clear that it's you know, we're still a growing company. You know, we're not going to be, you know, able to do some crazy, you know, endorsement contract. And her view was, look, it's not about endorsement contracts. I want to put some skin in the game. I want to be a part of this because, you know, I am now reached a point where I want to associate with brands that I believe in. And that was a very compelling statement she said. And, you know, it was literally, you know, for us, a no-brainer. You know, the first time we met her, we knew she was just the perfect person to work with. And she continues not just to be, you know, our brand ambassador, but also, as you guys rightfully said, an investor, shareholder, and also a mentor and an advisor. And it's just just wonderful working with her. Her insights, even on R&D, a lot of our products, by the way, go to her, not just the ones we've crafted with her. And she's very quick to give feedback. She does not hold back. You know, and it's just great, sort of, you know, having her part of the larger team and ecosystem.
Got it. Very interesting. And you know, I just have a follow-on question, and this is not very particularly in you know, on Deepika, but just for a lot of brand founders that would be listening to the podcast, right? In general, what does a, you know, like, what should a founder think of bringing a celebrity to perhaps be a part of the brand and endorse that versus probably getting, you know, 1,000 micro influencers? What would typically actually help attract customers?
Yeah, I don't think it's an if or. I don't think it's an or question. I think it's all about the strategic approach, you know, of the brand, right? I mean, at some point, you have to start with the micro influencers, and that's what we did. You know, we continue to have a lot of micro influencers, and you know, you want to use that to build the brand. I think what happens with you know, sort of a celebrity partnership or relationship is it lets you leap to the next level. So it also depends on, you know, when the brand is ready for it, because, you know, to not be ready for it also can hinder you, right? You don't want to be in a position where you're not ready on the back end or the supply chain or the scale to incorporate that, you know, into the sort of journey. So I don't think it's an or question. I think it's just a journey question. You know, it's about where you are and then who your audience is. And to me, what's very critical is not just the force feed an ambassador. It's also that the narrative and the brand and the essence of the brand and the DNA of the brand, you know, sort of fits in well with who the individual is and vice versa. I think that is where we get lost out. And in this new age of digital brands and social media, you know, that's going to become very, very important because consumers can see through the, you know, through the, forgive my language here, but can see through the BS, you know, that they know what's not real and what's real. And I think that authenticity is going to play an extremely key role going forward. And that's what's going to be very important for brands to decide. So to answer your question, I don't think it's an or question. I think it's a journey question as to which point you're in.
Sweet. Thanks, Rohan, for this really authentic conversation. All I want right now is to grab a yummy Greek yogurt. And I'm guessing some of our listeners may be craving some too. Dear listeners, if you like the episode, please do share it with others. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. And share any feedback with us on Twitter. Our handle is kcap_IN. See you next week with a new episode.